I'm afraid we'll have to wait till 6 p.m. for the news, but hello Bristol and welcome to the Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for St George East, Fabian Breckles. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we go back to the 1970s to pick up an incredible story of former Nazis living happily in South America, and even putting out disinformation through the world press to cover their crimes. A documentary team led by World in Action's John Ware was secretly filming them, and we reflect on why in 1963 the Israeli government pulled the plug on their own Mossad operation to bring Joseph Mengele, Martin Bormann, Klaus Barbie and other Nazi war criminals to justice. Plus, Martin Summers, we will have his usual roundup of world events. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight's lows of 11 Celsius, some showers and windy. I'm sure you've noticed that if you've been out walking this afternoon. This weekend, highs of 16 Celsius, a fairly wet weekend with some particularly heavy showers. Next week, highs of 20. Plenty of showers as well this week. That's about 4 weeks of showers we've had now, so you have to just dodge them. I'm afraid that's the only way to do it. Next weekend, that's the 30th of June and the 1st of July, highs 16 Celsius, sunny spells and a few showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, and time to introduce my guest now, and that's Fabian Breckles, Labour councillor for St George East. Hi, Fabian, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
Now, first of all, can you tell us a bit about your background? Do you have a day job as well as being a city councillor?
Yeah, I'm a civil servant and I do that full time, but obviously I keep my sort of political life completely separate from my professional life. Obviously you have to do that.
Doesn't that make you a little bit schizophrenic? You've got to think to yourself, well, who am I right now?
I think most people have multiple identities. You know, some people are into football teams, some people are into different kinds of music, and that's quite normal. I just feel that, you know, it's very important, you know, because we civil servants need to remain sort of impartial in the service they do deliver. It's important to sort of keep my political persona, where I'm not so impartial, obviously, you know, separate. So as on Twitter, you can follow me at F Breckles. I'm simply there as a councillor, Labour councillor, tweeting in his own personal capacity. That's it.
Yeah, but I mean, don't you have to sometimes, when you're thinking about whether to tweet something, think, well, hang on a minute, I shouldn't be saying that because I'm supposed to be an impartial civil servant. Doesn't it actually make you a bit clipped about what you say?
Well, the civil service, now I'm a councillor, because as you get time, you do actually get allocated time if you are allowed to, if you're elected as a councillor, you do get time off work to do it. So, you know, that's no problem with that at all.
Okay. Now, you're up in St George. What have you been finding from your the local people that live around that area? What sort of issues have you been bringing up? Because I know there's been a full council meeting this week, hasn't
there?
Yeah,
there has.
Did you get involved in that at all?
Yes, I did. And I made two statements to council this week. I made two demands. First of all, the council is looking at rolling out the 20-mile-an-hour zones. And I've called on the Bristol Lib Dems to use common sense in their approach, because as you probably know, in areas around St Paul's, Whitehall, they've just gone for a blanket approach of everything's 20 mile an hour.
Well, I can tell you, where I live in St Paul's, it's more like, it seems to be sometimes a 50-60 mile an hour limit, as it's a long straight road, Wilder Street, and people just tear up and down there with apparent impunity.
It's got to, you know, for 20 mile an hour zones to work, they've got to make sense. That means not the main road, that means not places like City Road, because, I mean, you know, it's so wide and so big, you know, but the narrow residential streets is where you need the limits. In my ward, for example, we've got real problems with drivers using unsuitable narrow roads like Charlton Road, the lower end of that, or Ferber Road to skip lights. You know, so instead of staying on Bryant's Hill and going through, or staying on 2 Mile Hill or whatever, they're just using these narrow, unsuitable residential roads for, you know, to skip lights. And if we had 20 mile an hour in those narrow roads and we had kept the main roads at 30, we could hopefully persuade most drivers to actually just stay on the main road where like you're supposed to.
So what do you really mean when you say you want them to use common sense?
What I want them to do is use local knowledge. That means talking to the local neighbourhood partnerships, consulting local residents properly, rather than just imposing a blanket ban 20 mile an hour limit on anything and everything, no matter how suitable or not. Consult with people, listen to people, and actually act on their advice. And if they say, put 20 down this road but not on the main road, act on it. If they say the whole lot needs 20, then act on that. But okay. Work with the people.
Okay, what about what else did you bring up at full council?
The other thing, as I'm sure you may have heard, there have been two horrific sex attacks in some narrow lanes, some pedestrian lanes in my ward. And I've actually called in, and they were overgrown and they weren't being cleared. And I've actually called on the council to develop a proper citywide strategy for keeping the lanes clear, because there's loads of lanes in Bristol, across not just in my ward but all over the place.
Okay, there's two things, aren't there, that make these places dangerous. One is when the greenery isn't actually being cut back anymore. Actually, yeah. If you go down many of our highways right around the country, there was a great picture in the Evening Post this week, for example, of one of the road signs as you're coming into or out of Bristol.
That's
I can't remember where it was.
I saw the photo.
And actually, there's nobody actually bothering anymore to cut away the greenery. So these signs are. I mean, for example, there are speed limit signs, there are such and such prohibited signs, all this kind of thing. Well, they're now, those signs are now just part of the undergrowth. In fact, and on a more serious matter, a couple of years ago, there was also a woman who was, she, I believe, wasn't killed, but two children in the car were killed. This is in South Somerset, North Somerset, you'll be glad to hear. But that was because the signs were obscured by overgrown vegetation, yes. And also the white lines in the road to say the road was ending and you were coming to a main road had also not been renewed. So this is quite a serious, you know, communal thing the council is supposed to do. We pay our council tax for them to do, and it's just not happening.
I know, I agree, it's completely unacceptable. It's about community safety and public safety, and it's absolutely essential that these lanes are cleared. Sometimes I've had situations where the council argued about, we don't know whether it's a public or private lane. I don't actually care. If it needs cutting back, it needs cutting back. This is about keeping people safe. So let's get real and let's get it back. The good news is I have managed to arrange for one of the main lanes in St George East to be cleared next week. Community Payback are going to come along and cut everything back, so that's a start. The May Gurney, for some reason, this you'll like this. I found out that while the lanes used to be cleansed as part of the previous CETA waste and cleaning contract, you know, so they used to clear the rubbish, somehow cleaning these lanes in St George, along with other lanes across the city, was somehow not included in the new May Gurney contract. I find that unbelievable. That's now being looked at, but it's very worrying. And
shouldn't this have been picked up 18 months ago or 2 years ago at the scrutiny for these contracts? You know, that sounds absolutely appalling. When this was brought in, this new May Gurney contract, we were told basically they were going to do exactly the same as the people previously had done.
We were told everything. We were told the sun was going to shine all day. I mean, it was, you know, yeah, it should have been picked up in scrutiny, but it is crazy that stuff like that gets left off a serious cleaning contract. They are now looking at reviewing that, of course, which is good.
Okay, were there any sort of really big hitters at the full council this week? Then any real big stuff came up?
Off the top of my head, I'm trying to think. The big thing was sorting out. The Lib Dems wanted to introduce a transport company, which gave the impression that they were abandoning moving towards an integrated transport authority for the Greater Bristol area. The rest of the parties, Labour and the Tories, you know, put a stop to that, and the Lib Dems did actually climb down and embrace a sort of a more coherent sort of approach. So that'll come back in September, and we'll see where we go from there.
Okay, and these full council meetings are actually open to the public.
Right, to the public, they're webcast as well, so you can follow them online.
Oh, right, so you can sit in the comfort of your living room on your laptop and watch the council strut their stuff.
You're suffering from insomnia.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, all right, and what committees are you on, Fabian? How long have you been a councillor for?
Well, I've been a councillor for St George's since 2007. I got re-elected in 2011. I secured just over half the vote, which was a nice endorsement. A lot of what I do is in the Neighbourhood Partnership. I'm the vice chair of that, so there's a lot of community work. I chair the transport subcommittee. No surprises given I called for 20 mile an hour limits, so we're trying to make things happen there. I'm the vice chair of DC North, which is one of the planning committees, so we deal with planning issues. I deliberately don't sit on the one for St George, so if constituents need me to lobby an advocate for them about for or against a planning application, I can do that, and I'm actually doing that now with some planning developments that are being proposed in the Crewes Hole area and the need for some regeneration down there. So I'm working with constituents and developers on that. So that's basically it. I also chair the Bristol Development Advisory Framework Panel, so we're looking at the whole issue of anything from, you know, zoning areas and what where we put housing, where we put employment land, and looking at the sort of structure of where what we put where in Bristol.
Okay, what are your thoughts on the this whole thing of the mayor? Because we were the only city, apparently, anyway, to say...
We were the only city yes, that said yes.
Said yes to the mayor. What was your view on it, first of all, before the vote? Now I'm sure you're all for it, because you've got your Labour candidate this week, haven't you?
Yeah, I had my reservations, but yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, Bristol's decided. It would have been nice if we'd had a bigger turnout, but Bristol's made its decision. Our job now is to make it work. I don't think there's any point in wasting energy worrying about what might have been or whatever. You just got to say, okay, this is where we are. We now got to get the right mayor. And I think Marvin, our candidate, is going to be first class.
So who is he? Can you just... Is it Marvin Rees?
Yeah. He's a local guy. He grew up... He lives in Easton, so he's actually a local guy. Probably someone you need to invite in to BCFM one evening. I'm sure he'll be happy to oblige. He's inclusive. He wants to listen to a lot of people outside the council, as well as working with us as his Labour colleagues. So obviously... The offer will be a coherent team working together, with him obviously leading from the front. Marvin's top, you know, offers the chance for visible leadership. He wants to develop a clear city vision and plan, and he wants to prioritise sort of re-engaging with the people who feel sort of shut out of it now. I mean, I'm sure we're all aware there's a bit of an anti-politics thing going on at the moment. It's like we're, you know, and the only way to address that is to actually start dealing with the issues that concern people.
But I mean, the thing that bothers me about the whole mayor thing is it's actually, in a way, it's doing totally the opposite. It's disengaging people from politics, because the people you elect as councillors, are going to have less power with a mayor, and so it's going to be there's going to be less kind of engagement with individual councillors and less confidence that councillors are actually running the city when you've got a mayor
in power. Get a mayor who'll work with the councillors, or whether you get a mayor who's a one-man band, doesn't want to listen to anybody and just goes on and does his own thing. If we end up with that kind of mayor, then yes, there's, you know, but if we end up with a mayor who will work with us, then no reason why we can't actually speed things along quite well by working together as a team.
Okay, now let's introduce old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin. We've had the G20 this week. What are your thoughts about that? My looking at it, it doesn't seem to me that they've come up with very much at all, actually, over there.
Well, it was being hyped as the Germans kind of caving into British and US pressure to basically consolidate the Eurozone, print Euro bonds and so on. And it was being spun by sort of English language media as the Germans have caved in. It's not clear that they have, and I think the market's picked up on that, which is why they basically have been tanking out a bit. The verdict on the G20 from the masters of the universe in the markets is this hasn't solved the problem, but then it was hardly likely to, given the depth of the situation that we're all in.
Well, an article in The Australian, this is this week's G20 summit in Mexico, the world's premier global economic forum, according to the Prime Minister, that's the Australian Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, was an embarrassing waste of time and money. It, like the others before, it was nothing more than a platform for preening politicians to be photographed at taxpayers' expense. The final communique was, as expected, a litany of glib clichés and meaningless economic verbiage.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, the Australians were not invited because they're not in the G20. Is that so? I can't remember whether they're in or they're not. That might be sour grapes if they've not been invited. But of course, Julia is quite right. It was largely a waste of time.
Yeah,
but
I'd agree with that as well.
But you've got to understand that they're struggling to come up with solutions against a background of everything, you know, the failing left, right and centre. And, you know, it reminds me very much of the kind of economic conferences that were held in the 1930s to try and stop the rot. And they all broke up in exactly the same way as this one. That doesn't mean you shouldn't have such conferences. Of course, in these days, it could all be done on the telephone. There is that issue.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is that the fundamental problems are not being addressed. They haven't been addressed. And we're still deep down the mine, and we're trapped.
Okay, well, I mean, I think maybe she'd agree with you. She finishes off the article by saying, the world is looking to the G20 for decisive action. If it is, the future's grim. The financial crisis of 2008 was a prelude to the far graver crisis of governments the world is facing. Shrinking to greatness might not work in the corporate world, but when applied to governments, it ensures a more prosperous future.
The shrinking to greatness thing, I smell a neoliberal here. In actual fact, what we need is government intervention, and they can't agree on it. And the whole idea that government is the problem, the reason why it's turned into a government problem is because we bailed the banks out 4 years ago. It was a banking problem 4 years ago. Now it's a government problem. It's a government problem because the government bailed the banks out. Now, if you're a proper free marketeer like the von Mises Institute, you say, let the banks go down. Nobody agrees with that. The banks were rescued. Now, that means we're not in Kansas anymore. The free market ideology is over, but nobody has accepted it. And it sounds like Julia hasn't got the plot yet either.
Okay, Fabian, what's your comment on that one?
I was going to say, I think you have a point. I mean, I do, the problem with the bank, it was a global banking crisis. I know that the coalition has tried to sort of perpetuate this fiction that somehow this was purely a British problem and it's all the fault of the last government. It wasn't. It's a global crisis. Absolutely. It was a global crisis caused by excessive deregulation. Everyone bought it. Everyone, while the boom years were going, the whole world sort of bought this idea that we were sorted, we were cool, and we weren't. And the solution is to accept that free market can't rule the roost. We have to think of something else. We have to have a regulated banking system that's there to serve the rest of us. It's not there, when you get casino banking, you get people making obscene amounts of money gambling on the price of commodities that if people in the third world can't afford, they will starve. That's grotesque. That's utterly vile. And we need to really ask ourselves why we're doing it like this.
Well, before we get off the subject of banks, NatWest and RBS customers have been frustrated by technical hitches over the last couple of days. The banks are blaming IT fault. The Royal Bank of Scotland was forced to keep at least 1,000 NatWest branches open until 7 p.m. yesterday following a technical glitch that caused chaos for millions of customers. The problem, which resulted in balances not being updated and online services being unavailable throughout the day, left some customers unable to pay for goods and services and unsure how much money they had in their accounts. Martin?
Well, I mean, one of the dangers we face, and it must be recognised, I know the mainstream don't often talk about this, but there's a possibility of a banking collapse, in which case we really are talking about ATMs.
Well, just to update you, this is the latest on this, is that RBS are unable to say when the banking problems will be fixed.
No, let's take their word for it that it is a technical problem, but it's giving people, it's like a canary in the coal mine. I used the coal mine metaphor earlier. This sort of thing can happen. People are so used to the idea of capitalist society as being this solid structure, which, although it may have its faults, is basically stable. It isn't, and it's not. And the danger is that we're not just going to have a recession, we're going to have a collapse.
Okay, so what if we don't take this at face value as a technical glitch, then? What do you mean by that?
I'm just pointing out that when banks go down, people will suddenly find that they haven't got access to cash and that cash is the only thing.
Are you saying there could be other motives for something going wrong at these banks?
It's not a question of motives. The situation is way out of control. The banks, as I've stressed week after week on this programme, are effectively insolvent. They've always been insolvent. We're pretending they're not, and we're coming up with more and more taxpayer money to throw down the black hole in the misguided belief that somehow that will make them solvent. It won't. What should have happened once we nationalised the banking system, which is effectively what we've done, is you dismantle the casino bankers step by step.
Totally.
But we haven't done it.
What
we did is we propped them up and then crossed our fingers and hoped that they would change their behaviour, which is hopeless.
I must admit, I do question what we're doing with allowing casino banking to continue now. All it does is put the security of everything else at risk. And I think surely the banking system should be there to serve governments, the people, business. If you're running a business, you don't want you don't want the banks gambling with the money that you need
access
to.
Absolutely, which was always forbidden in the bad old days of regulation. Casino banking was separated by the Glass-Steagall Act in the United States from retail banking for a very good reason.
Well, let's bring that back and...
I agree with you, Fabian. The problem we've got is it's stable door horse bolted. It might be a good idea to bring it back, but it's too late because they've already run off with the money.
But in the meantime, at the RBS, and this is in the Scotsman today, the Royal Bank of Scotland says it's unable to say when its banking service will return to normal. The RBS group, which includes NatWest and Ulster Bank, said it's clearing a backlog of problems caused by a three-day technical issue, which it believes is now fixed. Account balances have not been updated properly overnight, meaning that credit and debit payments are not showing up as quickly as they should, although RBS Group said the money is in the system. somewhere.
It's in the post.
Susan Allen, who's Customer Services Director for RBS NatWest Retails, told ITV News it was difficult to say exactly when all the problems would be resolved. She said they were due to an error in our system, which we believe we have now fixed, but we are having to clear the backlog. RBS apologised, saying it's working round the clock to correct the problems, including extending its opening hours. People going into their branch today could not necessarily see the most up-to-date information of their balances, although staff were said to be geared up to help. So, Fabian, this is really... I mean, you can't get away from the fact that this is partly due to the fact that there's now such a total reliance on computers and electronic methods for banking. You know, in the old days, you would go into the bank, you get your money over the counter. And this has largely been driven by demanning, hasn't it? By actually sacking individual, you know, human beings and going, putting your faith in computers, which has got to be a little bit iffy.
I think we'll never get away from computers in banking now. And so many people bank online. I mean, even I manage some stuff online. You know, you'll never get away from that now, but what we actually need is ensure the security of the banking system itself. That's what we need to do. And that means asking some big, awkward questions about casino banking in the future and whether that has a future and how we actually completely separate normal banking, the kind of banking that we all rely on and the listeners outside all rely on, from everything else.
Well, I think that's what the Conservative government, to be fair, are talking exactly those terms, which is quite brave of them considering that they're funded very, very largely by hedge funders and bankers. But nevertheless, as I repeat what I've said, it's a stable door horse bolted. Mm. Unfortunately, the situation we're in is one where the casino banks were bailed out. They then didn't change their behaviour, and they're probably going to crash, pulling everything down with them. Then, of course, we will start asking serious questions about the kind of society we want to live in. And these questions were asked at the beginning of the 19th century in a very serious way, and we're going to have to ask them again.
But now, this, Martin, all comes at the same time as Moody's has downgraded all these banks.
Yes, all these banks were downgraded last night. And, of course, that means, of course, that they're then scrabbling around to try and stay in the game. And ultimately, it's not going to work. I mean, some people would say, well, let the bad ones fail and let the good ones survive. That's what the von Mises Institute say. But the problem is there are no good ones. The derivatives market has led to a situation where they're all interrelated. Previously, like in the 30s, for example, the British banking system was the British banking system. Mm-hmm. Now it's not. It's everybody's owed money by everybody else. So it's become a failure becomes a catastrophic failure because it's all one system.
Like a pack of house of cards or dominoes.
Absolutely. And I think we need to prepare ourselves for that kind of outcome. And I think we need to start... I mean, and the Labour Party must not go too far too fast with public opinion. People aren't ready to do for radical measures yet.
But ultimately, Martin, it was the Labour Party that actually nationalised the Royal Bank of Scotland effectively by buying up the shares in it. And I think we would like to hear that actually to give customers for the NatWest and for RBS and for Ulster Bank a bit of confidence that this government-owned bank is going to recover all this information from their accounts, etc.
Yeah, I think we would. I mean, I don't actually bank with the NatWest RBS lot, but yeah, it is deeply worrying that, you know, they've got, you know, how they fix it, I don't know, but I mean, they've got to find a solution and they've got to make sure it's a sustainable solution. This can't happen again.
The Spanish banks have just gone bust, and I think we're going to see the shocks that are coming through the system now will take down the banking system, I fear. And that's not going to be pleasant. But I think it really will be the final nail in the coffin of the free market ideology when it happens.
OK, before we finally get off the whole banking thing and the G20 and the euro crisis and all that stuff, I dug out some information from a great little website called the EU Observer, which is one of the few independent Brussels-based journals that looks at the EU, which is actually readable. Now, they pointed out that MEPs are starting to bang their fists on the table, saying that the one important part of the Troika, that is, this thing called the Troika is the IMF. We had this conversation last week, if you remember, Martin. Yeah. The IMF, the European Central Bank, and the EFSF, European Financial Security Facility. Well, it does exist, and it's basically a private company based in Luxembourg, and the MEPs are complaining because they have got absolutely no oversight of this company. Mm-hmm. They only have to have a look at some very basic accounts once a year under the Luxembourg laws. So basically, this major plank of the euro recovery is a dodgy looking company based in a tax haven.
Well, that's absolutely right, Tony, and that's one of the problems. What it is a mechanism for bailing the banks out yet again, and Angela Merkel, who's been pilloried for being unwilling to do the right thing and all the rest of it, she represents German public opinion, saying, well, we shouldn't bail the banks out. But, of course, ultimately, she's not facing up to the reality. If you don't bail them out, they're going to crash.
The other point that's being made is the directors of the EFSF, the longer they can draw out this euro crisis, the more money they're making. They're making a fantastic amount of money out of it.
Well, the banks are making a fantastic amount of money out of it because once they've been bailed out, they've got moral hazard. So they by being bailed out without being disciplined, they were encouraged to go back to the gaming tables and go, yeah, hey. I mean, it's exactly what they've done.
OK, Fabian, I think I'll leave a final comment to you. What are your thoughts about the whole euro crisis and how it might impact, and that, or has already impacted in Britain?
Well, I think the questions about casino banking and are absolutely right, but I think it sounds like this company needs to be properly scrutinised. It sounds like you should have MEPs. I mean, we send them there to look after our interests. The whole of Europe sends them in to look after all our interests. Should actually have a proper scrutiny process in to actually manage the thing and watch it like a hawk and be publicly accountable for whether it succeeds or whether it fails.
Well, Martin seems to say it's not going to succeed, it's going to fail.
I think the other thing is that a lot of these commercial deals, I mean, they were saying at one stage, I think it was in the US, we can't tell you which banks have been bailed out because then people would panic. So it's all secret for commercial reasons, which is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Okay, on to more news then. And the G4S chief, this is the private security company, is predicting a mass privatisation of Britain's police. This is in The Guardian on Wednesday. Private companies will be running large parts of the UK's police service within 5 years, according to the world's biggest security firm. David Taylor-Smith, the head of G4S for the UK and Africa, said he expected police forces across Britain to sign up to similar deals to those on the table in the West Midlands and Surrey, which could result in private companies taking responsibility for duties ranging from investigating crime to transporting suspects and managing intelligence. Well, as far as I know, they already transport suspects. The prediction comes as it emerged that 10 more police forces were considering outsourcing deals that would see services such as running police cells and operating IT run by private firms. Fabian?
I think this is really frightening. I mean, it's all sort of all a bit RoboCop. I mean, I recently bought the three RoboCop movies on Blu-ray, and, you know, watching one of those, it's all about a private company that gets too big for its boots and everything goes horribly wrong.
Ultimately, sometimes these private companies can come in and do jobs actually cheaper and more efficiently than the public sector.
Possibly, but I think we need to make sure that law enforcement is done by a body that is publicly accountable. I think, you know, it's one thing seeing sort of a G4 van taking prisoners to and from between prison and trial and all of that. We've obviously got privatised prisons. But I think when it actually comes to enforcing the law, enforcing criminal law, that needs to be done by a body that is publicly accountable, not just a bunch of contractors. That's a bit frightening. That sort of makes the accountability, who they're accountable to, us, the people they're supposed to be protecting, or the shareholders of the company. That's the line that we need to avoid crossing.
McMartin, the article goes on to say from The Guardian, I've always found it somewhere between patronising and insulting, the notion that the public sector has an exclusive franchise on some ethos, spirit, morality. It is just nonsense, he said. The thought that everyone in the private sector is primarily motivated by profit and that is why they come to work is just simply not accurate. We employ 675,000 people, this is the boss of G4S, and they're primarily motivated by pretty much the same as would motivate someone in the public sector. In the £1.5 billion deal being discussed by West Midlands and Surrey Police, the policing activities are up for grab, including investigating crimes, detaining suspects, developing cases, responding to and investigating incidents, supporting victims, witnesses, managing high-risk individuals, managing intelligence, engagement with the public, as well as more traditional back-office functions such as forensics, legal services, and the vehicle fleet, finance, and human resources. So he's basically saying, what is the difference between us doing it and the public sector doing it? Because he reckons he can do it more efficiently and more cheaply.
Well, it's the difference, if you want to use a military analogy, it's the difference between the British Army and Blackwater. Ultimately, these kind of things where you're taking people's liberty away are very importantly to be seen to be totally transparent and above board. Otherwise,
absolutely.
Otherwise, people are going to start saying, well, we're going to fight G4S boys when they come around this council estate because we don't believe that they're, you know, we don't trust them,
absolutely.
We don't respect them, we don't believe what they're doing, they're in it for the money, well, let's blow their heads off like we used to do in Belfast. That's the problem with all of that.
Totally. I mean, I must admit, it is extremely dangerous, this, because I think you know, if you, you know, I was just thinking there's a place for everything and everything in its place. Some things belong in the private sector, some things belong in the public sector.
I think law enforcement is a classic. Even in Adam Smith, he doesn't suggest that law enforcement should be handed over to private companies.
Totally agree with you. They should be out and out. We need to, you know, there needs to be total.
Including private prisons, incidentally. I remember meeting a Danish guy at a conference years ago, and I said, well, we're going to have private prisons in Britain. He was incredulous. Incredulous.
Well, what's the problem with that?
If you're taking away people's liberty, and all the rest of it, that's a very, very important thing that a society does, and it's got to be seen to be absolutely fair. And people making money out of it. I mean, the private prisons in America, they lock people up for 3 strikes and you're out when they've been smoking a bit of dope or something, and then they get locked away for 30 years, and they're all money's being made out of it. There was a case in the US where a judge was sending juveniles to prison, and he actually got shares in the prison. Yeah, that's the sort of problem.
Yeah, well, the Lord Chancellor, Kenneth Clark.
That's corruption. I mean, that's beyond belief, isn't it?
Well, he was caught out, but on the other hand, it was a possibility. It wouldn't be a possibility if the prison wasn't private, would it?
Well,
that's true.
Ken Clark, the Justice Secretary and Lord Chancellor, is really pushing an expansion, not only of private prisons, but also of work that's done, cheap labour within prisons.
Well, as John has said, Marina's husband has said, who used to work in a prison, this has been looked at loads and loads of times, and there's two things wrong with it. A, it breaks EU competition law, because these people are slave labour, and the people mm-hmm. you're in competition with will say, hang on a minute, you're not paying proper wages there. And secondly, supervising prisoners who don't want to work is actually very expensive. It's much cheaper to bang them up and leave them in the cell.
The other thing, of course, is it creates an incentive for actually making new laws to criminalise people, because then you've got a private profit being made
idea,
in prisons.
And it's extraordinary that somebody as long in the tooth as Kenneth Clark came out with it, because this idea has been raised umpteen times, and every
Maybe
time
he's got
the civil service
in S4C.
Well, even so, it's just a non-workable idea.
Okay.
Another wizard wheeze.
Okay, on to our next story. Ed Miliband is promising new immigration measures to protect British workers. Big announcement today. One could, if one was cynical with you two Labour Party members in here, say, well, this is shutting the stable door after the horse is bolted good and proper, because there's nothing he can really do now. There's plenty of people who are now able to come to Britain and have come over a very long period of time. So what are your thoughts on this? Is today Ed's promising new measures to prevent British people being locked out of jobs by foreign workers, including forcing firms to declare if they employ high numbers of immigrants. Fabian?
I think Ed's absolutely right to apologise. I think we did misjudge this, and it did come up on the doorstep. I think it is right that we need to work with sort of changes like immigration, stuff like that. We do need, you know, we need to work with people, but at the same time, ultimately, probably we're all immigrants. I mean, my family's been here about 1,000 years, but I'm half Anglo-Saxon, half Norman.
But that's not the point. The point here is that people are coming to Britain who are prepared to work for half or less than that of the wages that people in Britain need in order to pay the rent and pay the mortgage.
You're hitting the nail on the head. You're hitting what the real problem is. A lot of it is people are making a fortune out of bringing people in from Eastern Europe and elsewhere who will work for way below the minimum wage and who will live in squalor. I actually went to a trade union presentation some years back. And, you know, people are being brought into working agriculture. They're being forced to live in overcrowded, slum-like conditions. They are paid below the minimum wage, and they're then charged a massive chunk of that to pay for their accommodations. They're being paid virtually peanuts, and, you know, to work day in, day out. That needs to stop. We need to enforce the minimum wage. We need to go further than that and go for a living wage. The way to deal with exploitative immigration like this is to actually manage the demand. And if you've got to pay a living wage to somebody, whether it's the chap up the road or somebody from somewhere else, then you've got to pay the living wage. And I think that's a much, you know, that will deal with it. And, you know, it's simply not right that we're having almost sort of a modern day slavery with some people.
But Martin, this is very, very safe for Ed, isn't it? Because this has already happened, and it's not as if he can really change things now. I mean, he can change to a certain extent to encourage employers to tell the job centre how many foreign workers they've got working for them. But ultimately, you know, the wages in Britain have been driven down by immigration. It's happened.
That was the neoliberal philosophy, full stop. And that's the problem. I mean, Britain, in fact, I mean, other European countries decided to keep they didn't have to liberalise their immigration from Eastern Europe as quickly as we chose to do. because we were in the throes of a neoliberal idea that it was going to be great. And in many ways, the economy did grow faster for having this cheap labour influx. So people have got, you know, there's a plus side to the balance.
So do you think that there's an attempt here by some people to sort of conflate the economic, genuine economic problems people have of getting a job when their wages are being undercut with a sort of racist approach?
Well, of course, I know, don't forget that in Eastern Europe, I was an aid worker and an economist in Eastern Europe during the 80s, the 90s. The neoliberal philosophy there smashed employment in places like Poland. They've still got a huge unemployment problem over there. And of course people will move if you've destroyed their local industries. We're talking about agriculture. Polish agriculture has been destroyed by globalised competition, which is not fair competition. It's completely subsidised. They've just been wiped out. And of course, then you get Polish boys ending up in Herefordshire working on strawberry farms in Herefordshire, big factory farms. There was a perfectly viable soft fruit industry
sort of
in
sounds
Poland,
to me,
which was smashed.
And sounds like a bit of a domino effect from country to country.
Well, exactly. The problem is that the workers all over the world are being played off against each other. It's not just in Britain. And we're going to have
it's
to
about
get
making the poor people fighting each other for scraps while the rich get richer.
Exactly, exactly. And we've got to actually change the macro policy so that there's enough work for everybody.
Absolutely.
And if there's enough work for everybody, there's nothing to moan about, is there?
And also it's more environmentally sustainable for food to be grown and consumed locally. So British food is eaten in Britain,
indeed.
Polish food is grown,
I mean, a lot
and
of East
Poland.
Europeans would have stayed home had their own economies not been trashed by the IMF in the 90s.
And also another problem we've got to think about is with rising youth unemployment in this country, are we going to end up with a situation where people are having to, where British young people are having to leave and go abroad hunting for work, and are we going to end up who's going to pay our pensions if that happens?
Well, indeed, of course, all of these, you know, people shouldn't see people coming here to work as a problem.
No.
I mean, they are contributing.
Now, what the government is saying at the moment is that they've introduced a benefit cap because they want the average wage, they want anybody to be on benefits to have more money than someone who's on the average wage. But then, of course, that average wage has been brought right down and down and down.
Well, we need to think outside the box. We were talking about having vision earlier. The Greens have been saying this for years. We need a citizen's income for all those who are British citizens, which basically provides enough to live on. And then you work on top of that. You wouldn't get that if you were from outside Britain. You would come in on a different basis.
Now, but sort of building on what Fabian was just saying about trying to get the poor people fighting amongst themselves, a bit like Diane Abbott was saying, the whole divide and rule philosophy,
even though
she was ticked off for it. On the other side of the coin, you've got the Jimmy Carrs of this world, who are squirreling away their money in tax havens.
Interesting that Cameron wouldn't criticise his chum from Take That, Gary Barlow.
Well, I mean, that's been picked up on, hasn't it, by the mainstream.
Exactly.
But the other thing I'd just like to point out, an article in The Guardian, Friday the 20th of April, Cameron family fortune made in tax havens. It says David Cameron's father ran a network of offshore investment funds to help build the family fortune that paid for the Prime Minister's inheritance, The Guardian can reveal. Though entirely legal, the funds were set up in tax havens such as Panama City and Geneva, explicitly boasting of their ability to remain outside UK tax jurisdiction. At the time of his death in late 2010, Ian Cameron left a fortune of £2.74 million in his will, from which David Cameron received £300,000. Cameron and other cabinet members have recently suggested they would be willing to disclose their personal tax filings amid growing scrutiny following the budget, but this would only shed light on annual sources of income rather than accumulated wealth or inheritance. Martin.
Well, I think that this is Cameron was very unwise to raise this issue, because considering that it's glass houses and stones. I think ultimately, if we're going to deal with the crisis, and we're talking about banking collapse, we're talking about mass unemployment for a generation, we're going to have to get a little less prissy about asking how much people are actually worth. And one of the things that we used to talk about in Eastern Europe in terms of getting the oligarchy and the mafia to pay money is basically looking at their wealth, not their income. There was ideas to send out a questionnaire that everybody would have to write down all of their assets.
But I'm quite interested in...
very resistant to that, lots of questions would be asked, well, you've got all these assets, but your income is this, how come? And of course, that's when you start to find out who's on the take.
I'm quite interested in the fact that Cameron's dad was a real pathfinder in creating these sort of tax havens. In fact, a long-term Panamanian investment fund performed the above market rate for many years, averaging 116% return from 2002 to 2007. Today, many of the fund's largest holdings are in blue-chip stocks, such as Apple, Unilever and Coca-Cola. Ian Cameron was also chairman and shareholder of Close International Equity Growth Fund Limited, registered in Jersey, worth £9 million, according to papers filed in 2005. In that year, just under half of the fund's holdings were in UK-listed stocks. Fabian?
I just think this is robbing ordinary taxpayers. We, most of us earn an ordinary wage and pay our way, and though even it was in the eye, there are millionaires who do pay their full tax, and so there's no excuse for people using these tax havens to protect.
The thing is that they are legal. We had on Newsnight,
legal,
I think it was last night or the other
time,
night.
Maybe we should be shutting down these tax havens.
We had Jacob Rees-Mogg saying, well, look, I mean, it's not fair to criticise people for doing something which is perfectly legal. The thing is, you've got to change the law to stop them doing
totally.
It.
Totally. Why is this legal?
Why did Labour not do this? Is it the fact that you've got rather too many people at the top of all the political parties who are making a few bob out of this?
Well, maybe there is. Maybe we should have a debate about having a maximum income and higher taxes. You know, it's all this big conversation about where we're going and why we're going there that we need to have. And, you know, it is quite clear that the very wealthiest in society aren't really being affected by this global situation at the moment.
Well, I mean, for example, Ken Clark on Question Time last night was asked about this, and he actually sort of blushed red, and he was saying, oh, we really must do something about this, but he was going red at the time. So I'm afraid it seems to me that there aren't any politicians, although they'll talk the talk, they won't walk the walk on this one. Anyway, Marina, thank you very much. What have you got for us this week?
We will talk about changes in examination system. Plans announced by Conservative Education Minister Michael Gove to replace the GSE SE examination system with a two-level system similar to O-levels and CSCs have been widely condemned. Liberal Party sources are saying that the proposals would represent an acceptance of mediocrity, which would let down our kids. They claim that neither the Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg nor the Lib Democrat Education Minister Sarah Tether had been consulted about these changes. The leaked plans to change the examination system from 2016 have been denounced as ludicrous by Mary Boster, leader of the Association of Teachers and Lecturers. Former Education Minister Lord Adonis rejected the reforms as bringing back the CSCs that end exams for children treated as second rate. According to Dan Rogerson, the co-chair of the Lib Democrat Parliamentary Committee on Education, rather than hacking back on age when children started their adult life, this qualification that were seen as second rate, we want to look forward and work with teachers and schools to give them the freedom and tools needed to stretch pupils, drive up standards, and entrench a culture of high expectation in every school. Gove is apparently determined to press ahead these reforms because Lib Dem support is unnecessary since there is no need for parliamentary legislation. Many Tories are angry with Lib Dems who failed to support Jeremy Hunt in a Commons vote last week. What questions should Gove be asking his department? Why do some children fail in examination whilst others succeed? What cost will children pay if they are labelled as second class? And what will be the consequences for society of a new army of depressed, unhappy or unemployed new citizens? Are these changes designed to create future limitations or opportunities for both children and society? Gove looks set to make his name better known to the public. What do our children really need?
Okay, Marina, thanks very much. Fabian Breckles, you're a Labour councillor in the city. What are your thoughts about these proposals to change our examination system?
Well, I think it's appalling. I did sat some of the last O-levels back in the 80s, and I think returning to a two-tier system will actually write off those kids who are on the lower exam. I think maybe the GCSE exam does need reform. If people can keep on resitting until they get through, maybe that needs looking at, and we need to make sure that they're an accurate reflection of someone's ability. But I really I think having a two-tier system is asking for trouble and is actually asking to write people off a very early stage, and I don't think that's right at all.
Martin, I know your family's in education, now retired. What are your thoughts on this? You've got a bit of experience of the whole examination system and which way works and which way doesn't.
Well, I mean, I agree with Fabian. I mean, as you can see, it's just like in the health service. They're not listening to teachers. They're not bothered to consult them.
Exactly.
They've just come up with this on the top of his head. But I'm asked, well, what was Gov's education? I'll bet you will find he went to some private school somewhere or some top grammar school or something.
But that, I mean, you can't condemn the guy for that.
No. But what it leads to, Tony, is they've got no understanding of what goes on in schools like this one here. Which has got a great local
reputation. The City Academy you're talking about.
The City Academy. It's got a great local reputation. Loads of people want to come here. There's a long waiting list. But they provide GCSEs and they provide for all levels of ability and stretch everybody to the limit of what they're able. What the problem with the old system was is it stretched the people at the top and the rest of everybody else was written off. You know, you failed the 11 plus, you left school at 14 and you went down the pit. Of course, there is no pit for them to go down now.
No.
And that's all
that
changed.
Was Thatcher.
Yes, I know, but the point is that we need to bring up all of our children with high expectations.
Couldn't agree with you more.
And also, we do need to actually reform GCSEs because there's too much prescription in the national curriculum.
Absolutely.
Everybody doesn't need to know what the capital of Peru is. It's ridiculous.
I think one of the most important
things... What is the capital of Peru?
Lima.
Lima, yeah. One of the most important things education can do, as well as giving you the basics, is teaching you to think for yourself, because that way you can learn how to assess and ask questions about life as you go through it. But yeah, I think Gove has completely lost the plot. It's interesting, one of our most popular education ministers we had when Labour were in power was Stephen Twigg, and he had a very good reputation for working with and getting alongside the teachers, and that's critical. If whatever parties in government, the education secretary has got to have the respect of the teaching profession.
But what about the
alongside them.
What about the political row over this, you two? Because the Liberal Democrats are furious. They're saying, "Well, look, no one asked us anything about this," and they've now leaked it to the newspapers as a possible proposal for the future.
I think Gove's just making policy up as he goes along. I think he's completely lost the plot. It's a bit worrying, really. But of course, if the Tories start sacking him for being useless, then they'll have to get rid of a few other useless people as well.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's all gimmicks, isn't it? It's headlines in the Daily Mail. And it's like, look, our children's future is much too important for that.
Totally.
There ought to be a consensus across the parties about education. It shouldn't be a political issue. We should all basically be on the same page. But they're still fighting a culture war over it. If they want a culture war, we'll have a culture war. 7% of people in this country were privately educated, but they provide virtually 90% of the political and other leaderships in the country.
And how much tax do they pay?
And also, of course, from the frontline teacher's point of view, like my sister and my parents, what really angers them is when they're working hard with some of the most disadvantaged kids, there's no support or backup. They're just told all the time, you're rubbish, why aren't they learning their times tables, why haven't they started on their Latin yet? And it's all because these people live in a different world from frontline teachers in inner city schools.
Okay, campaigners are hoping to reopen a derelict cinema in Bristol. They've collected more than 1,200 signatures calling for the venue to be reopened. This is a petition calling for White Ladies Picture House Cinema to be restored. Fabian?
Well, I've been, you know, really into old cinema since I was a kid. I'm a member of the Cinema Theatre Association. I used to go and see films at the White Ladies Picture House when it was the ABC and then the Canon before that and the MGM and whatever names you had in the 90s. It's a great place. It would be wonderful to see it back as an arts and entertainment venue. There's some horrendous plans by the current owners yet again to try and turn it into a gym. They also want to put flats on the site, which would absolutely deface the thing. We've got to stop this. The planning meeting is next week. There's a petition online. I'm sure if you Google...
We don't do Google on here, really. We'll say your favourite search engine, but I can tell you what the website is. It's www.whiteladies-picturehouse.com. That's the website. You can go straight there, but you can use any website you want,
whichever search engine
to find it. And it's basically
you sign up.
It's called the White Ladies Picture House campaign, and there's all sorts of stuff on there: news, history of the place, how you contact the group and get involved, etc. Martin, it's about time, isn't it, that something was done with this building? I can remember about 8 years ago, 9 years ago, there was a developer that took it over that promised they were going to build a gym there, and nothing's happened since.
Well,
it's been still just an empty shell. And originally, the Odeon sold it with a restrictive covenant on it.
That's been removed, I think.
Well, I mean, I'm aware of this campaign because one of the campaigners spoke at the Speaker's Corner events that we run in the centre of Bristol every second Friday of the month. and he was arguing the case for for it to be retained as an arts facility. Mm-hmm. I mean, but basically, he was making the point that the city council promised in the 1960s that they would have a theatre, because there was a theatre, the Old Vic or something, and he said that promise has never been kept.
Mm.
And I think we've got plenty of gyms.
But isn't the real problem that a lot of the filmmakers, people who are actually paying money for them to make these films, are now also controlling the outlets? And so they're controlling... It's a kind of... what do they call it? Vertical integration, mm-hmm. where they start to control the entire industry, and there's very little choice. Anyway, let's go to director of last year's Venice Film Festival, Marco Muller, to see what he had to say about the world. The state of the world film industry right now.
We are facing a situation where our screens are occupied by American films. They have very strong strategies to maintain that occupation. I mean, I think it's really a matter of, you know, getting used to having a reduced variety of offerings for your national films. It never goes beyond 20% of the screen space. In Italy, the producers, and especially the big production groups, they have devised a system to counter the American attack, and that is to serve simple comedies to the audience, and that's how we finally reverse. We are facing a situation where our screens are occupied by American films. They have very strong strategies to...
Yeah, that's sorry, that sort of seemed to repeat itself somehow there. But anyway, he's making a very good point, I think, and that is that the US basically controls much of our cinema network, and also the films being made and distributed. So they're controlling what we see in here, and it rather frustrates me that this can't be just run as a little independent cinema of some kind that's got its own choice. Now, I know you've been in San Francisco recently, haven't you?
Yeah, I was in San Francisco. What's interesting is over there, and obviously that's part of America, there is actually a lot more choice out there, and you've got cinemas like the famous Castro, where we went and saw the Third Man. Big 1,600 seat cinema from the 1920s, completely unspoiled, completely as it was when it was built, still showing films, still being family run business. If they can make cinemas like that pay in America, why can't we make them pay over here? I just really think that another big problem that we've got is lack of imagination. We don't really have the choice in films, and maybe we need to be thinking about sort of European quotas, or maybe to try and get more variety in the cinemas. But it really is annoying when you've got five multiplexes we have in Bristol now, and they all seem to be showing largely the same things with one or two different films in one or two places. And I think there's a lot more choice that we could have out there. And this is a big problem. I think there is a lack of imagination in some of the big operators.
Martin, briefly.
Well, I'd just like to congratulate Ken Loach for winning the Cannes Film Festival with his The Angel's Share. I mean, he's consistently producing stuff, and he's a local boy, lives in Bath, and he often comes to Bristol to support our left causes in Bristol.
Yeah.
And more power to his elbow.
OK, on to our next story. And Assange is ready for an arrest if he's denied asylum, says a colleague. Well, this is the story, of course, about Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, is holed up inside Ecuador's embassy in London to avoid extradition. He will leave the embassy and face arrest if the Latin American country turns down his asylum request, his colleague said yesterday. In a dramatic twist in the long-running saga, the former computer hacker fled to the embassy on Tuesday and now risks being arrested the moment he leaves after breaching bail to avoid extradition to Sweden. Alternatively, Ecuador may allow Assange to stay at the embassy indefinitely. Fabian, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, he's being sort of hunted down almost as if he has already been found guilty, when actually he's not even been charged in Sweden
yet. I think everyone has a right to a fair trial, no matter how much they manage to annoy America or anyone else. I do think, obviously the allegations need investigating, but I think we need to... It's a complicated mess, and it was actually being discussed by the people on the last radio station, because I was listening to BCFM as I came down here this evening after work. It's very hard to know how to manage this. I mean, because obviously he's worried that if he goes to Sweden, Swedes will deport him to America, and that's where he'll be basically locked up and I'll throw away.
But it's a bit of a turn up for the books to see someone looking for justice in Britain having to run and hide inside the Ecuadorian embassy, Martin.
Well, it is, and it'll have gone to the Ecuadorian embassy because their leaders in the Bolivarian bloc in the Americas aligned with Venezuela.
Well, so they're basically, they're anti-American, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, fundamentally, yes, that's why he'd be there. I mean, basically, various US politicians have called for him to be killed, assassinated, never mind just prosecuted. Now, would that count as hate speech? Perhaps it doesn't. Perhaps I can call for those American politicians who've called for Assange to be killed, to be assassinated. Let's see what they do about that. Sue me if you dare.
But ultimately, what's going to happen now, because he's stuck in this embassy, is he just going to have to live there for the next few years? If we wanted to do an interview with him, for example, we would have to go into the embassy and interview him.
He was interviewed on Press TV, as you know, and you had a clip from it. No, he was interviewing Nasrallah, wasn't he, for Press TV. I mean, Assange has bravely gone to take on the people in power in the world, and more power to his elbow. I mean, I'm sure he wouldn't necessarily want to be in this situation, but if you're going to put your head above the parapet, you've got to expect it to be shot off. But, you know, on we go. We are exposing their lies.
Okay, Fabian, I'll give you the final word to you on this. What do you think is the future for radical internet publishing if Assange is arrested, is taken over to the United States, and then ends up incarcerated there?
It's very frightening, because I do think we do need discourse, and the internet, this is where the internet can be useful in actually getting people to ask questions about what is going on and why are things happening, and that needs to happen. If we end up with ideas being suppressed, that's the start of real totalitarianism, and that's really quite frightening.
Okay, well, we're coming up now to the time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, Labour councillor for St George East, Fabian Breckles. After the news, we go back to the 1970s to pick up an incredible story of former Nazis living happily in South America and even putting out disinformation through the world press.